Hey, Justin.
Hey, man. What's up?
So, how was your holiday?
Are we talking about holidays? Like, it's by the time this is on the air, this is probably like at least February by now. So, my holiday is a long time ago. I barely remember it.
Well, I got to tell you, man, I feel inspired. I feel so inspired. Opportunities happening everywhere, and I have to tell you that you know why I'm inspired? It's because. You know those guys that say that they can take a laptop and work anywhere and make money from the beach?
That's me.
You know,
that's me.
That is you. That is you.
Except I work from my home in where I've always lived my entire life, except for that part.
That's true. But you're kind of by the beach, so close enough.
True.
But this guy is actually, he has a laptop, will travel with his family. That's always, I want to, like, that's the next thing I want to do. And that's who we have. I'm so excited. So do you want to know who it is?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Well, let's play some theme music first. And then I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Andre Sturgeon.
And I am Justin Womack.
We are the Marketing Geeks.
Marketing Geeks.
All right. So our first guest, well, our guest, for the show, George Clooney couldn't make it. is an author of a book called "Screw the Zoo," which
love that title, by the way. Love that title.
Yeah, it wasn't what I expected. I actually expected something else. But this book, actually, the content of this book really.
Oh, it's a book. I think I looked at the wrong one too.
Yeah, okay. That's not my arrest record. But this guy wrote this book, and he is also an SEO expert, and he lives a nomadic life with his family, where he just like makes his money doing what he does, traveling around the world. Doing it, man. Like, this is how it's done. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam McRoberts.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming on the show, man. Really appreciate it. I'm curious about this because, you know, the dream of every digital marketer is to do what you're doing. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, based on what I didn't cover there.
Well, how did you get from where you started to this nomadic lifestyle that you're living now, like as an expat?
Oh, goodness. It was a long, winding road. I've always been a bit restless. You know, if I stay in one place too long, I get itchy.
That's really weird. Really weird. Most entrepreneurs like love like monotony. That's strange.
And thankfully my wife is the same way. And so about 2 years ago, probably about two and a half, you know, we made the decision to plan it out and start traveling around the world. And our original goal was to do it for at least 4 or 5 years, see if we could make that work. And so far, you know, 2 years in, I think we've been to 13 countries, 14 or 15 cities. And it's awesome. I mean, I wouldn't trade this for anything.
Yeah. So what were you doing before that? Like, how did this whole thing get started for you?
So, I mean, a long string of jobs kind of led me into this, but it all started back in high school. I had an English teacher who challenged me to learn how to build websites and write copy for him. Weirdest thing ever, but hey, extra credit. So I did. And at the same time, you know, eBay was just getting started. And my mom, who always loved going to garage sales and finding cool stuff, started up an eBay business. So she'd find something interesting at a garage sale and turn around and flip it for more on eBay. So I'd help her, you know, write listings and research products. So that kind of got my feet into the industry.
So what year did you graduate high school? I'm just curious because you're probably pretty close to me.
I graduated high school in 2001. And this was in 99.
Me too. It's exactly the same year I graduated high school. So that's why. Okay.
Yeah.
I was just thinking the eBay timeline matches up. This all matches up. Okay. Got it.
Yep. Yeah. I've been there since the early days. You know, back then SEO was stuffing keywords in funny places and getting links from any directory you could.
and visit text.
Right. Yeah. Not much to it. Things have obviously changed since then. But starting in probably the mid 2000s, I started doing this full time. And have stuck with SEO and various facets of digital marketing ever since. But for me, it's a really cool puzzle. It's fun to play chess with Google And so this is it's what I do, more or less. I figure out what moves Google's about to make and head them off at the pass.
So were you ever a person that had like a normal job and then you were just like, oh, to hell with this, I'm going to do this other thing? Or did you just like always have the entrepreneurial spirit?
Or college too. Is there any college in the story also?
There was two semesters and a term worth of college before I quickly realized that there's absolutely nothing college had to teach me that I was interested in learning. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had a string of normal jobs. You know, this was a side business for me for the longest time. And anytime I was in between jobs, this was my full-time business. But I haven't done anything but voodoo marketing since middle of 2017. I always hated having a normal job. Stuck in an office, 40 hours a week, cubicles, total crap. I hated it. And, you know, it was never a question of like, will I get out? It was always a win, always a win.
Man, that's exactly same scenario with me. I would always have these jobs and kind of go, oh, that's a pretty good job. Wonder how long I'll be here. But in the meantime, I'm always digging a hole underneath my poster of Lana Turner, you know?
Such a good movie. Shawshank Redemption is great.
Yeah, man. You got the geek reference. But so there was no real like big transition. It was more like you kept moving forward until you didn't have to have the job anymore.
Yeah. You know, I reached the point in 2017 where I actually made more money from the side business than the full-time job living in downtown Seattle. And it was like, all right, we can make this work.
So you started Voodoo Marketing, and that's V-U-D-U marketing.com.
Now, isn't there like a video player or like a, wasn't there another company called Voodoo? Who was first?
There is. I think they were first, and that was one of the reasons I did it. So I was working at a small agency, and one of the clients, we were explaining something, and the guy was like, yeah, I don't care. This is all voodoo to me. You guys just make it work. And I was like, that's cool, voodoo marketing. And then around the same time, there was the video streaming company Voodoo that I think later got bought by Walmart and maybe just recently got shut down or something.
Yeah, I think they just recently went down. They're gone now, I believe, yes.
Yeah, and I was like, all right, well, that's a cool way to spell it, and maybe the two will like connect in people's minds so it makes it easier to remember. So I went with that.
So you mostly do SEO. You do like SEO audits, strategy consulting, but you also do training. So was that something that you added later, or was that kind of something that you built out in conjunction with the business as well?
I added it later. I mean, there's always like a training component working with any sort of clients in the digital marketing space. But I actually went around, you know, it was probably early 2017, I started building out an SEO training course that was the kind of thing I wish I'd had in the very beginning, because I learned this stuff piecemeal, you know, forums, random blog posts, trial and error.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the best way to do it. Not the most.
Yeah.
When you got started, though, like when you came out of high school and kind of started your own little side business, did you go right into SEO, or did you start like a blog and then kind of just try to rank that naturally? Like how did this start and how did it evolve into SEO? Because even though your high school teacher told you to write web copy, it doesn't necessarily take you straight into SEO. So where did that come from?
No. So, I mean, I'd been on computers since late 80s, early 90s. Yep. Watched all the search engines grow up, Lycos and Hotbot, and most of them were garbage. And then, you know, Google comes along and changes the game by using links as part of the graph. So I start building these websites, and this is right about the time Google is taking off. And so I'm like, all right, well, I'm making random sites about random topics, you know, not really making money from it, like stuff that interests me, stuff that interests my friends, throwing them up on like the free hosting on Fortune City and GeoCities and trying to find it, right? Like, all right, I put up this site. Like, how do I find it? You go to a search engine. Oh, it's not there. Well, what do? And I think there were, you know, a small handful of people who were starting to blog or talk about it on IRC and just kind of picked it up. But it didn't become like an actual business focus until probably 2007. 2006.
I was
in college. I was majoring in philosophy. I hated it. I love philosophy, just hated college. And realized, like, you know, there's nothing that they're teaching here that I actually want to do for a career. And around the same time, I got a job working at this small web design agency, and they did web design, pay-per-click, SEO, social media, you know, ran the gamut. I was like, this is interesting. And as I started digging in deeper, I was like, oh, well, some of this is familiar. Some of this is new, but like, this is something you can't learn in school. And that seems like a really good thing to have under your belt. So I just stuck with it. sure enough, you know, learning skills you can't pick up in any sort of formal institution is quite lucrative.
Yeah, no doubt. And so what do you use for your platform for your online curriculum?
Teachable.
Okay. Okay. We've had a couple of our guests say that that was the way to go. One of them built this whole preparatory system for his learning curriculum, and he said at the end of the day, I should have just used Teachable. If I had to do it again, that's what exactly what I would do. So, okay. And for those of you who don't know, Teachable is a way that you can do online curriculums fairly easy. It's a platform designed just for that. So what was the moment that you decided to take this next step, which was, you know what, I can do this from anywhere. I'm gonna just do it. And what was that conversation like with your wife? And you know, your son was younger then. So how did that idea form, and why did you do that?
All right. So this was actually kind of a long runway with multiple false starts. So in 2007, the 4-hour work week comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Stands out on the shelf to me. I'm like, well, that sounds a lot better than 40. Pick it up, read it. I'm like, okay, I got to figure out how to do this. So I started leveraging what I read from that to get the agency I was working at the time to implement a remote work program. So I was one of the first 2 or 3 people to pilot this remote work thing.
Nice.
I immediately went from the 40 hours a week to working for maybe 5 to 10. And the way this agency was set up was every deliverable that went to clients had a fixed amount of hours attached to it for billing. And so as long as I was billing 40 to 50 hours worth of tasks, nobody asked me how much time I was spending. So yeah. I was incentivized to find a much faster way to do it. And nobody at the company cared because the work was high quality and on time and, you know, sufficient.
And ultimately, I just want to say people pay for results. So I think like this idea of getting caught into how many hours something takes is kind of a ridiculous notion, because if you're really good at something, you can do it faster. Shouldn't you get paid more?
Exactly. Because what you're also paying for when you charge that amount of money, what the client is paying for is all the hours that you had to struggle to learn how to do this stuff that when it wasn't available.
Yeah. What's the old story about the guy who comes to fix the photocopier?
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, it's like, we paid you how much to fix that? It took you 5 seconds. He's like, yeah, well, you paid me because I knew how to do it, not right. because of how long I spent.
You knew which, I knew which screw to turn. That's what you paid me for.
Yeah, I think the story I heard was like, it was, here's the invoice. It's a penny for the screw to actually do this. And then the other $999 is for that lifetime of expertise that I've amassed over my over my history, which allowed me to know which screw to turn.
Exactly.
So was there a moment when you're like, you know what, I want to get out of the United States, or you're leading up to that?
Yeah. So, all right. So read the 4-hour work week. And one of the ideas he planted in there was one of travel, and it's something that I'd wanted to do. I was like, all right, I think at some point that would be fun to do. Well, not too long after that, you know, me and my wife, we talked it through. Like, at some point, we definitely want to travel, but not yet. Don't have enough money yet. So put it off, and then ends up deciding to have a kid. So right about the time we find out we're going to have a kid, I get laid off from that job. So I'm like, all right, well, this is a good time to do at least a test run of like full remote working. Let's see if I can get a business off the ground and run it. No, I absolutely was not ready at that point in time. So I made, you know, a little money, but nowhere near enough. So I went back into the full-time workforce, provide for the family, did that for a few more years. And then in 2014, late 2013, I left another agency that I was working at, and we decided to travel. So packed everything up, took my kid, who was 3 at the time, and off across the pond. We started off in Italy, and we ended up spending about 2 months before we called it quits. Traveling with a 3-year-old is no fun.
It's like traveling with someone who took all the acid and didn't leave you any.
Yes.
And now you've got a babysit.
Yes, it was.
That's what it's like.
It was too much. You know, like I was earning enough money to make it work, but it was just too difficult to travel with a child that young, at least for us. And so we're like, all right, back to the U.S. We'll try again when he is older. And we set somewhere between like 7 and 9, you know, 8-ish, give or take, depending on how he's doing, to do that again. So went back to Seattle, another job after that, all the while building up the side income more and more. And then in mid 2017, I was working at a startup, and man, me and the CEO, we just butted heads on everything. And finally I was like, listen, man, if you don't back off, I'm going to deck you. Like, I can't take any more of your crap. Like, the guy was just, dude, it turns out he had some family personal issues going on, like, but it was serious. Like, yeah. he was an absolute asshole to everybody.
When you take these kind of jobs, are you independent contractor, or are you actually an employee for these companies?
Full-time. I was salaried. I think all of them have been salaried roles, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, I just, you know, like, I'm not a violent person, but this guy just pushed all the buttons.
Yeah. And when that happens, I mean, when I've had that happen to me a few times, I agree with you, not a violent person, but what I do is when that happens, I'm just like, what is the universe really saying to me at this moment? Right. Like, how did this situation pull this, like, dark behavior out in me? And that's when you do the reevaluation.
Yeah. And so, like, over the weekend, you know, I was like, you know, it's time to quit. I'm done. So I come in on Monday and they're like, we're letting you go. I was like, perfect timing, because I quit. So that was that, out the door. And I was like, all right, you know, let's start socking away, like, earn as much money as we can, as fast as we can, start packing up our stuff, selling stuff. Like, we're gone. We're bouncing out of the US.
Yeah.
And we did. So about 6 months later, we took off and haven't been back since.
Wow. And where'd you go from there?
We went to Costa Rica first. And then,
I love Costa Rica.
You know, like, we actually didn't enjoy it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was fun swimming in the ocean and all, like the sharks and the rays. But dude, the humidity and the bugs were just insane.
The bugs are a little out of control. That's true.
Like, yeah, it felt kind of sketchy. And being hot and sweaty, no matter what time of day or night, and all the bugs, we couldn't do it. The tropics is not for us. And so after that, we went to Spain, which is much more our speed. Really nice beaches, no bugs, not very humid, much better. And then we've just been bouncing around Western Europe ever since.
Nice. And where are you right now?
In Croatia.
Croatia. How's that?
It's actually pretty good. It's a little chilly.
Yeah.
I'd say the weather is very similar this time of year to Seattle, but less rain. But we really like the city. They have some really cool Christmas markets. Public transport's pretty solid. Good food options. A bunch of play places, like indoor play places, which my kid loves.
Yeah.
And, you know, ironically, the internet here is actually pretty good. We have 100 megabits connection here. So, yeah, you'd be surprised. Like, the best internet I've found on all our travels was in Bucharest, Romania.
Wow.
Oh, that's wild. You wouldn't think that, but I understand that Bucharest has there's like a kind of a tech hub over there.
Yeah, there is actually. There's a lot of Microsoft, I think, has a place there. Nike's there, a bunch of other companies.
Well, let me ask you this. So how are you now that you're on the fly, you're traveling the world. So how are you getting your clients now? I imagine that SEO is going to play into this. But tell me, like, so how are people finding you? What kind of work are you doing? Are you doing a lot of, like, consulting? Like, are you doing, like, Zoom calls or Zoom consulting? Or, like, what kind of work, like, fills your time? And how are you making your money primarily these days?
Yeah, so almost all of it comes from audits and strategies. So, you know, a one-off productized service. And the leads come, ironically, in the SEO space. Relatively few leads come in from actual SEO. It tends to be word of mouth or speaking at conferences or past clients coming back or making referrals, that sort of thing.
Podcast interviews.
So the vast majority of mine just come from a network that I've built up over the years. And I also do a lot of white label work. So I have a bunch of different agencies who use me to do audits for their clients.
Smart.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's the public speaking, you know, and you're a published author, which gives you credibility. We talk about that a lot and on the show. We talk a lot about writing a book ourselves. I mean, we really
we're so close.
We're so good at talking about it.
You should do it.
We should. You're right. We should. And so we're going to talk about
so
that.
So we shall.
But
I want to do this. I want to take a step back here, Sam, and I want to talk a little, get into the tactics a bit, because a lot of the listeners listen to the show are interested in the tactics. They want to learn, okay, like, you're an SEO expert. Teach me a few nuggets of SEO. And I realized, like, that's not something that we could do, like, in short order. But if you were going to give, like, you know, your 2 cents to somebody that's wanting to kind of get into this. Maybe they have a slight background in SEO, but not like an advanced one. What do you see as like the key focus areas for search engine optimization and going into 2020 here?
Yeah, and just to piggyback off of that, yeah, the trends, because you've seen it from when it was like keyword stuffing all the way up to where it is now.
Yeah.
So not only
from black hat to white hat.
Right. So not only like what are the kind of with the new Google just did an update of their algorithm. So not only like what that is, but what you picture beyond that.
Sure. That's a lot. Okay. I think the best place to start is by understanding Google's business, right? Google makes their money from advertising. They get people to look at their ads and click on their ads by showing them really good search results. So Google is in the business of answering questions as accurately and efficiently as possible. And that's the way they think of it. Every time somebody goes to Google and types in something, they're asking a question. And Google's in the business of serving up the best possible answer for that question, hopefully with some ads on top of it, so they make some money. And so really, over the years, all Google has been doing has been optimizing their algorithm to better understand the two halves of the equation, to better parse and understand what somebody means when they search, because some of those searches can get really wonky, and to match that up effectively with the best possible answer of everything that they've combed on the web, which is, you know, trillions of pages of information. And so Google has been working diligently to get better at matching up those two things. And a big part of that has been their investment in artificial intelligence, right? You know, natural language processing, image recognition, better understanding everything that they've crawled and scraped and mined, as well as what people are typing on a day-to-day basis. So most of the updates that Google has made over the last few years have actually centered around that. They've been, I'd say, largely one of three things: either getting rid of sites that are blatantly trying to manipulate them, better matching up searcher intent with answers, and prioritizing sites that provide a really good user experience that aren't frustrating in any way, shape, or form. So those are the three things that Google cares most about, right? Get somebody an answer that's accurate, get it to them fast, make sure they're not frustrated in the process. So as an SEO, really, you know, your job is to help people to make sure they're creating content that does a better job of answering a question or a search than the current content that's out there, that does so fast and painlessly, and making sure that you include all the little bits that help Google to understand what's there.
And this is all kind of led to this transition from black hat SEO, which were the kind of shady tactics, like way back when, like using invisible text, keyword cramming, like manipulation of the system to get rankings, where now they actually want, when somebody searches for something, they want them to have a quality experience and get their questions answered. So we're actually moving into this stage now of fulfillment on what the on user intent. So are there still black hat techniques that you see out there that are working, or is this like almost entirely now a white hat system that just has a, you know, the key focus now is like on content and just like keeping your page speed optimized, things like that? Or tell me a bit about that.
I mean, there's still some black hat stuff that works. Most of it tends to be in the sphere of link building, you know, buying links, link networks, private blog networks, that sort of stuff. And, you know, Google's getting better and better at catching that. Like when you have an enormous mountain of data, it becomes very easily to spot anomalies. So yeah, especially on the link building side, like it's not hard to spot a site that is subpar, but seems to be getting a ridiculous number of links and from crappy places or strangely connected sites. Like they're pretty good at finding most of that. But sure, you know, there's still some things on that front that work. And there's still some like technical and in some cases outright illegal things that tend to work. You know, there's some things you can do on the hacking side or the malware side that can, using bot networks to do searches and click on search results and manipulate dwell time and like that type of data signal.
Yeah.
There's stuff you can do, sure.
But so there's still people ahead of the curve, of course.
Always. Okay. And most of those are in like pills, porn, and poker.
Of course.
That is my Saturday night, man.
name of his book, not our book, but his book.
That's right. That's right. I'm writing it in crayon. So tell me, do you have a bead on, like, where this is going ultimately? Like, where do you see the future of SEO being? Because, I mean, basically what you said is what, you know, we've said a million times on this program, which is, you know, the key to a good SEO is create content that will, you know, answer the question. And the deal is to find the question that people are asking the most. And, you know, doing your research to find out what those questions are. But where do you see the future of this going?
A couple of things. I mean, Google's showing a lot of what they perceive to be the future by how they're changing their search results. So seeing a lot of like knowledge panels and really short answers showing up directly in the search result. I would say if your website or your money comes from answering very simple questions with very short snippets of text, you're screwed short, mid, and long term as Google, you know, answers those questions themselves, right? Like, it's in their best interest to keep people on Google and show them more ads. They don't really want people to leave and go elsewhere. And so the more questions they can answer quickly and simply, the more they're going to do so.
We had one SEO guy on our show who said, where do you hide a dead body? Page 2 on Google.
And it's true. I mean, the vast majority of organic clicks stay on that first page.
Yeah. I mean, I that's definitely me. If I'm searching, I don't find it on the first page. I might look on the bottom to see if maybe it's phrased differently, but usually I'll just reframe my search and stay on page 1.
Can we talk about a few tools that you might use? Like, we've had people on the show that have talked about software like Ahrefs or SEMrush or some of these kind of SEO optimization tools for both content and for keywords.
Yeah.
Are you using any tools like that? Can you share a few with the listeners?
Yeah, those are great. So the tools break out into a few different pieces. You have keyword research tools, you have link indices, and then you have like crawling and technical analysis tools. So in terms of links, Moz, Ahrefs, Majestic, and now SEMrush, each have a huge database of links. They crawl the web a lot like Google does and pull down data on who links to who using what anchor text and when it appeared. So those can help you to understand how things are linking to your site, how your competitors are linking to what or getting linked to by what. And then you can use like SEMrush or Answer the Public, or there's a ton of others for keyword research to understand exactly what keywords people are looking for and how frequently, roughly. And then you have like technical tools. So things like Screaming Frog or Sitebulb that can help you to pull down the sort of technical data from a site that Google would be looking at. Those are all
tools. What does Sitebulb do? I haven't heard of that one.
Sitebulb is a lot like Screaming Frog. So it's a crawling tool. It goes through the site, it crawls link to link, and it extracts all of the data from each page that it hits, you know, how long the crawl took and how many images are on the page and what the URL and anchor text and alt text and all the other tags and SEO bits in the code. It pulls it all into a database that you can then analyze and sift through to find problems.
And do you see page speed as like a key factor these days? It seems to me that it's pretty important.
Yeah, they just keep dialing up the crank there. And as you think about it, like more and more people are using the web through a mobile device. A lot of those people are in countries where the mobile speed is not great. And so in order to provide a non-frustrating experience, faster sites are better.
And finally, people are starting to buy from mobile devices. For a while, it was like they would search on mobile, buy on desktop. Now it's pretty much all mobile. And soon it'll just get more and more and more and more. And
so you have to design the site for a mobile first experience. No doubt about that. So, well, let me ask you this, as far as, like your, let's say that two things. Number one, I have a client and the SEO isn't that great, but I find like, I see that other sites are linking to certain pages that are giving them higher ranking. How would you get your site listed on those sites? What do you do as a strategy?
Well, I mean, the most common is to reach out to those sites and say, hey, you know, we see you've covered this company here. We have a similar article or a better article. Would you link to us? You know, in some cases, just asking is sufficient, but that tactic gets used a lot. And depending on the site, it could be oversaturated. Webmaster could be sick of getting requests like that. So usually it's better to use some honey. You could send a gift basket. You know, hey, we love your site. We think you do really great stuff. Thanks for doing what you do. You know, people feel a need to do reciprocity. So like, well, wait a second, like, who are you and why are you sending me a basket? Oh, you know, well, we're in this industry and we've seen you cover our industry before and we really love what you write. So thank you. And now it's all of a sudden like, well, maybe we should write something about him because that was really cool.
And by the way, you owe me. Even though you don't owe me anything, you owe me.
But like, yeah, you know, yeah, leveraging that need, that reciprocity, that need to like balance the scales can work.
Yeah, we did a whole series on the influence tactics in the book Influence by Robert Cialdini. So we did a whole thing on the law of reciprocity a long time ago, but we did it.
Yeah. And that was definitely, you know, it's a great technique to help influence people. And what do you do if your site is on a low ranking site that might be dragging down your SEO?
What do you mean? Like your site itself is not good, or the links, or
the links? Yeah. So you're like your site shows up on a bunch of low quality links. Is that something that you just ignore and move on from, or is that something that you try and actually get those links removed?
It depends. You know, if it's a handful of crappy sites that just appeared one time, you can probably leave it. Google's really good at filtering out that sort of stuff. If those links are rolling in steadily over time using keywords that you're actually trying to rank for in the anchor text, that might look to Google like you're the one doing it. So those are some you might want to look into disavowing. But
is that how you crush your enemies? You're like, you know what? I'm never going to rise above this company, but I'm going to take them down.
Yes, actually. I mean, negative SEO is a thing, even though Google tries really hard to pretend that it's not. And that does seem to be one of the keys. It, you know, if you do something that's likely to get somebody penalized and you do it consistently over time, the same way that they would do it if they were doing it for themselves. Yes. To a degree.
Wow, that's crazy.
So SEO, crazy. Sun Tzu, the art of war and SEO. Okay.
That's also using the dark side of the force. So if you tend to be a light worker and, you know, you want to be in integrity, don't do that, folks. Be in integrity. That's a public service announcement.
I've had people talk lightly about this, but I've never really gone in depth conversation about like this whole attacking SEO thing and purposely creating negative SEO for somebody else. So that's a fascinating topic.
It works. I mean, I've tested it. It's a thing. Google's tried again to get better at it. So the last time they rolled an update to their Penguin algorithm, which deals with link related stuff, and this was years ago, they made a switch where instead of penalizing a page for the links pointing to it, they just ignore the links instead. And they do that for the most part, unless you're doing something very egregious. But that was why, because it was just too easy at that time to do exactly what I just said. And it can still work. It's less likely to, though, because of how they handle the links. But that's one of many, many ways to do that.
Now, have you noticed any major changes with the advent of voice technology the way it's taken off? Everybody's got a smart speaker in their homes now. I know for years we had Siri on our iPhones. And I know that there's a thing, I think it's called natural language or what they call
semantic
it.
Speaking.
Semantic speaking. So how has that impacted things, or is that mostly just getting picked up by AI? And can you talk to that at all?
The second one, really. I mean, voice search hasn't taken off the way people have expected, which kind of makes sense. I think down the road, it may be a bigger deal, especially once things like augmented reality actually grab a foothold.
Actually, like have devices that you can wear that don't look ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
prediction show like a couple of weeks ago. And my prediction is that voice technology will not take off because I'll feel like an idiot if I'm like, no, I want to see the monkey video out loud on the subway.
Yes. And, So I think that's part of it. There was actually a company at CES this year that has a functioning contact lens augmented reality display, which was kind of cool.
Oh, they do. Oh, that's cool. Because we've talked about that for a while, a contact lens. That makes sense to me.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I had not seen anyone do it yet.
Okay. Yeah. I think it'll follow the trajectory of, you know, glasses with some sort of an accessory pack and then just glasses, eventually contact lenses. And if, you know, Elon Musk has his way, some sort of brain implant.
Definitely brain chips are the way to go. Neuralink and get that thing implanted into my brain. Can't wait.
I know he's going for version one. I'm like, no, man, you got to wait for at least version 3 or 4. Come right? on now.
Yeah.
No, because as soon as I get hooked up to the machine, I'm going to be so smart that nobody will ever be able to catch me. And then I'm going to sabotage everything else and nobody can catch up, right?
You know what? Unless he's running a program that makes you think you're smarter than everybody else, when in fact you're banging your head against the wall going, hey, Elon Musk, I got a chip in my brain. Monkey video.
Yeah, that's probably more likely.
Yeah. So this is all like super fascinating to me, especially with the advent of AI. You mentioned that you think it will take off, but do you see a point where that there's going to be a recalibration of how the internet is done in general? Because, you know, with Russia and China, basically it looks like they're creating their own networks that won't be connected to the rest of the world. What do you see the future internet looking like?
You know, I mean, it's probably going to get even more decentralized than it already is. Like originally the internet, the entire idea behind the internet was decentralization, and it's become more centralized along the way due to governments and ISPs. But I think it's likely that it will once again fragment. It maybe something to do with blockchain will help that to actually function. But I think it's still, I think that's still quite a ways out. You know, Russia and China are always planning for the worst case scenario because they're always messing with everybody else.
Yeah.
So, but like as far as search, I think it's going to shift, but I think it's probably going to stay largely the way it is functionally for at least the next 5 to 10 years before we see any major, major changes.
So do you think that AI will ever replace you at all, replace like the us SEO people? Or do you think that there's going to be a need for human input always?
It's hard to say. I guess it depends on how good they get at making AIs not a black box. You know, if it can explain clearly why it's spitting out what it's spitting out, then you don't really need somebody like me. But you know, my job really is to play a translator. You know, I sit between you and Google. Like Google says X, what they really mean is Y, and all the stuff that they don't tell you is Z. And I'm here to help you like parse that and figure out how to apply it to your specific situation and your specific competitors. But maybe, I mean, maybe at some point, I think we're still a ways out.
So let's say that you are you're just starting your business, you know, and you are a person out there, one of our 7 listeners, maybe, who is looking to do exactly what you want to do, like get out of the United States, for instance, and travel. What would be the first thing that someone would do to make that shift happen, to make that transition? Like, what would you recommend to somebody?
Oh, boy. I mean, first, honestly, I'd ask, like, why? You know, why is it that you feel compelled to go off and travel? Like, are you trying to escape from something? Are you just looking to taste what it's like to roam and be free? Because, you know, honestly, I feel like a lot of people end up traveling because they're trying to run away from something. And at least to some degree, like that was also me. I was sick of a lot of the political crap in the US. I was sick of being trapped in a cubicle, and the idea of travel like seemed like the opposite of that. And I love it, but it's definitely not the life for everyone. There's a lot of trade-offs. Like you're untethering yourself from, you know, your friends, your family, the things that you're comfortable with, possibly your language. And it's not always easy. Like sometimes the utilities aren't great, or the internet's not great, or there's problems with traveling or problems where you're staying. So it's not a stress-free, problem-free way of life, but it is an interesting one. And for me, at least a fun one.
Yeah. So how would someone kind of like, what would be the first thing that someone would do as far as like the skills that they need? And then what would they need kind of on their laptop, skill-wise, sure, and the tools in order to do what you do?
So, I mean, you're going to need a skill set that can be done from a computer anywhere. So that kind of relegates you to selling products online, be they digital or physical, something in the digital marketing space, or something in the creative space, writing, graphic design, videography, things along those lines. So if something in there, you know, tickles your fancy, that's probably a good route to go. As for the laptop and programs, I mean, it depends enormously on which of those things you do. But say for me, say you want to get into SEO. You would want to learn the basics of what that means, the places where you could get jobs doing that. you would probably want to start building some sort of a track record immediately. So build your own site, try and get it ranking, see if you have any friends or family who have websites that they need help with, and do that. So you can get some testimonials and some track record that you can point to for other clients. And then, you know, once you feel like you have a decent grasp of the space and you have a little bit of a track record, start putting up listings on Upwork, you know, or Craigslist, or watching for people who are trying to hire an SEO. Maybe they don't actually need to have somebody full time. Maybe they take somebody as a contractor to start, and do that and just rinse and repeat. Get experience with clients, get experience, build it up, get bigger clients, get better clients, and do that over time. I would not recommend packing up and traveling until you have at least some sort of consistent income coming in. It doesn't have to be a ton, but at least enough to float you. I wouldn't just like drop everything with no money and go and like hope you figure it out as you fall.
And I would agree with that. And I think, yeah, there's got to be some level of practicality to it. And like, yeah, if you've read Tim Ferriss, The 4-Hour Work Week, I mean, I think that title gets people so excited. But if you actually read the book, it's a very tactical book, and there's a lot to it. It's a heavy book. And some people even don't even want to read it because they get alienated by that title. But it's actually a great, great book.
Oh, I loved it.
I reread it every year. And I mean, I've chatted with Tim a bit off and on over the years. And it's like people misperceive what the book is about. Right. The book is about efficiency. It's about understanding all the things that you're doing that you don't need to, and all the other things you could be doing that are much higher leverage. And so, you know, the title is very tongue in cheek. I think he said at his lowest point, he actually got down to just an hour or two a week. But the problem was that he was working like 80 to 120 hour weeks and doing all this pointless, fruitless crap. And once he finally like stripped it all away and got himself out of the inner workings and put processes in place, lo and behold, you know, you're no longer needed for this business you've built to function. And I think that's it. You know, it's not that there's some magical amount of hours you should or shouldn't work, but you shouldn't be spending time that you don't need to.
Absolutely. Now, one thing I want to address though is this book that you wrote. You wrote the book Screw the Zoo. This came out, it looks like 2015. Is that right? 2015?
2015.
Okay. So this is like, you had already done a false start with traveling the world, but maybe you were working with somebody else at the time and you wrote this book, I take it. Yep. Like tell me a little bit about the genesis of the book. I have not read it. It sounds fascinating because it actually gets into a little bit of philosophy, it looks like, which I love, and psychology. Tell me a little bit about the book and the process behind writing it, like why you wrote it, and just a little bit about what that looked like.
So, I mean, from the time I was a little kid, I have always had this sense of feeling trapped and feeling compelled to poke at the nature of everything around me, reality. And so, you know, I've always been searching, trying to understand like why things are the way they are, why things work the way they do. And I'm kind of obsessed with the movie The Matrix, and in particular,
the documentary.
The Matrix says in Keanu Reeves. Yeah. But like the Morpheus quote, right? Some rules can be bent, others can be broken. And so that kind of is what drove me to write Screw the Zoo. Along the way, I had found a lot of things that people take for granted. They assume they're rules, they assume they're required or prerequisite, and they're not. And there's a lot of other things that just... there's a lot of things in general that keep you trapped. Some of them outside, some of them inside. And if you feel trapped and you're trying to escape, you need to understand what your cage and the bars and the locks look like so that you can get out. And so Screw the Zoo, it's not like your typical nonfiction book. Like it's not, I don't have one premise that I cover at the start and then rehash endlessly until the end of the book to meet page requirements. It's about 50 different core concepts that stack on top of each other to try and help you to see reality more clearly and then play the game as you see fit once you understand what all the pieces are.
So one of the things that struck me when I was doing my research for this podcast was on your front page of your website, which is really just, it's kind of humble, just talks about you. But you have a quote by Andrew Carnegie, which says, "Reality is negotiable." And what does that mean to you?
So I think this is, you know, I think of that quote kind of like a Zen koan. There's a lot of layers to it. And, you know, on one hand, it could be saying like, hey, look, you know, like all these things that you accept as necessary or required, like maybe they're not. maybe you could ask for a little more or do things a little different. But, you know, going a level deeper, like, I couldn't even tell you with certainty what reality is or if we're in it, right?
Yeah,
I don't know that. And philosophy, you know, kind of arrives at the same conclusion. Like, all we can know with any sort of certainty is that we appear to be conscious. There's a sense of what it's like to be us. That's it. Everything else is built on top of that and is uncertain. So you could, right, you could go pretty deep with the quote, but I think Andrew Carnegie, like, he may have gotten it on both levels, because what he accomplished was astonishing.
Yeah. And I tend to buy into that reality is spongy, and especially now in this day and age where it's hard to tell what is real anymore. And that's not going to get any simpler. We're only going to move into a world where reality is completely up for grabs. But I think that also gives us as human beings a opportunity to create a reality of our own choosing. And I certainly live by this philosophy and feel that this version of reality that I am living in is like the ultimate form of where I can go. And from here, I can even make it better, right? And it sounds like you kind of subscribe to that as well.
Yeah. So there's this concept. I think it was early last year, maybe late in 2018, somebody tipped me off to a book called Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing by Jed McKenna. And in that, he has this concept of people are in essentially three buckets. They're sound asleep. They are aware within the dream, aware that they're dreaming, or they are awake. Corresponding roughly to your average person, your sincere seeker, and your enlightened being. And so, you know, I feel like I'm in the middle. I realize that I'm in a dream and I see that, and I can see that reality is not as it appears to be. And it kind of just gives you a very interesting frame. But what one of the things that Jed says in there, he's like, look, enlightenment is a booby prize, right? This is not the thing you seek. It's something like you're compelled to do come hell or high water. He's like, it would be much more enjoyable for you to just enjoy the amusement park, right? Have fun in there, realize that you're in a dream and just enjoy it, have fun. And I think that's a really good attitude. Like, maybe we're in a simulation, maybe it's a dream, maybe it's a game. Like, I don't know, but I'm here. And as long as I'm here, I might as well have fun and make the best of it.
Enjoy the experience of where we're at.
Sure. And even on a scientific level, like, our brains are only capable of interpreting like only a very, very small fraction of the stimulus around us. So it does seem that there's another layer that we just are not aware of in reality. And that's why I kind of buy into Elon Musk, who says it's more probable than not that we are in a simulation right now. So
yeah. And it's funny, like, when I first heard him say that quote, I was like, really? Like, how do you feel comfortable stating probability like that without like sufficient data? But since then, I've spent a lot of time digging into that world. And it's like, you know, there kind of is some data, and some of it's tenuous. Some of it's also quite astonishing.
Well, yeah, and especially because you consider that at some point humans will create if we survive this long, we'll create some sort of mechanism that will allow us to have a fully immersive experience. It's so real, we don't even know that it's a simulation. That's
indistinguishable.
That will happen. So if that will happen, who's to say?
Why hasn't it already happened?
It's happening right now.
And it seems incredibly reasonable. And, you know, there's a lot of little threads that kind of point to that. Like, I just yesterday, so a couple of days ago, I wrote a Twitter thread on a bunch of movies to watch to help you question the nature of reality. And in there, somebody tips me off to a recent movie called The Mandela Effect. I'm like, all right, I've never heard of this. So I buy the movie. I watch it twice yesterday because my mind is absolutely blown. The Mandela Effect apparently is a whole series of things that people like in mass tend to misremember.
We've talked about it on the show.
Oh yeah. Like I remember when Kris Kristofferson died. I remember it because I wanted to call my friend who was a big Kris Kristofferson fan, but I remember reading it. And the next thing I know, A Star Is Born comes out and Barbara Streisand is like hanging out with him. I'm like, how is that possible? He is dead. Lance Hankerson, you know.
And I just want to say that we didn't, I mean, I have not seen the movie. I don't think Andres has seen the movie, but we've talked about this for over a year before the movie even came into existence.
Like, awesome.
This was a thing on the internet. So we've been really into this whole concept before the movie. I actually want to see the movie. But yeah, we'll keep talking. Tell us a little bit more about like the movie and what you discovered.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't believe I'd never come across this previously. Like I watched it. And I was like, no way, no freaking way. The one that stood out to me the most was the Berenstain Bears.
Right.
Like, yeah. I mean, yep. I remember with crystal clarity reading those books, like all of them as a kid, watching the cartoons, like going to the library and checking out the videotapes. Like I remember it, man. It was Berenstain, not Berenstain.
Yeah, no,
I'm 100%. I mean, we're around the same age because we graduated the same year in high school. I 100% remember the Berenstain Bears. Like that was it. Like it's that one blows my mind. And then the other one is the Monopoly Man with the monocle.
Yes.
Like that one's so confusing to me. And the only explanation that I could give is like, I think of like Ace Ventura 2, where he like had the guy with the monocle and called him the Monopoly Man. And maybe I'm conflating the two or something, but I really don't know how else to explain that.
I read one. Yeah. I read an explanation where they're saying that perhaps you're conflating it with like the Mr. Peanut guy.
Maybe, I don't think so.
Like, no, me neither. Like, you know, and so I ran a little poll on Twitter. I listed out a handful of these things yesterday, and almost across the board, people remember, you know, a different version from what reality seems to show. So not proof by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, there are other possible explanations, but it's pretty weird.
It's definitely fascinating. And this is like your glitch in the matrix, or what I like to say is if this isn't like a simulation, it's like we're seeing multiple realities. Like if there's a theory that, you know, every time you have decisions,
Everett's mini world hypothesis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're seeing all these different converging realities and what it would look like in a different alternate reality.
Well, Justin and I always joke about the fact that we know that this has got to be a simulation of some sort, because whoever's writing the script about American politics right now is, I'm not sure if it's genius or just like...
Well, it's great for ratings, all right? I mean, this is the highest rated season of American politics in a while.
But that's the point, because honestly, if I had read this in a book like 20 years ago, I'd been like, that's crazy. No one would ever do that. And then... here we are. So I totally buy into this. And I think that reality is far more complex than our earthworm brains can understand. But then again, when I did ayahuasca, and I hung out with a multidimensional being.
That's an experience I don't share with you.
That's,
but yeah.
So yeah, I haven't done Aya, but I've done LSD. I've done shrooms and, you know, tried a few other interesting substances. But yeah, psychedelics definitely make you question everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that don't take this stuff lightly. We're not condoning the use of this unless, you know, you have everything, you know, a proper guide, a proper set and setting.
Yes.
But the thing is that ultimately, and the research is coming out now about psilocybin, and basically saying that what it does for the human consciousness is quite astounding, and makes connections that are in some cases strong enough to overcome PTSD and traumatic experiences. Yeah.
That's a whole nother topic there. I mean, but there's a whole organization called MAPS. Yep. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but they are looking at psychedelics as a way of treating mental disorders or abnormal psychology condition.
Yeah, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, I think.
Yeah,
it sounds right.
I've known some of those people. A great, great organization. But the thing is that when you do something like this, and really, you know, again, you have to do it in the right. Like I didn't. When I did ayahuasca, I went to the Amazon and found a shaman who I could trust. I didn't do it with the guy with the white robe in Ojai because, you know, he did it the most times.
How did you know you could trust him? Did he have a good like Google presence or?
No, I talked to his assistant for a long time and it was just like, I just felt it. But the thing is that those particular experiences crack open your psyche to the point where you realize like, wow, everything in life is just kind of a program. It's an algorithm. And depending on how much you hang your hat on that algorithm or buy into that algorithm, that could dictate your reality. Is there a free will? I mean, obviously, as a philosophy major, this question comes up.
I mean, you know, like, depends on what you mean by that. Like, by default, no. You know, you're driven by subconscious impulses almost across the board. Like, can you take some measure of control? Yeah. But, you know, a lot of that control may still end up being an illusion. Hard to say.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the decisions that we make are under the guise that we think we're making them under free will. But there's so many influential factors that are just subconscious or unconscious to us that are impacting our decisions that we don't recognize. Not to say you can't rise above them if you are to like take a step back and get into that kind of state of enlightenment. But many of us never get there. And we're making decisions that are we think we're making, but we're really just following orders almost. I don't know how else to put it. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I think Scott Adams calls it like the moist robot hypothesis. And in a lot of ways, sure, you know, your brain is a lot like a computer and you run programs that get loaded on there. And that's essentially what memes are, you know, any idea that sticks and replicates. And so I have a name. I'm a part of this religion. I'm a member of this school or faculty. I have this job. I'm a parent. I'm a husband. Like, all of these are roles, but they're also programs that you load up and run. And most people are completely unaware of not just the programs they're running, but what those entail.
Exactly.
Yeah, because you filter all your decisions and you filter some of your opinions through that program.
Hugely, so hugely. And I mean, the brain makes so many like sacrifices for efficiency. We're never actually seeing reality the way it is, right? Like, just because of the brain's need for efficiency. So it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that, we got to close out the show. But I love that we started with just like SEO and we went to this whole cosmic place. But before we go, I want to find out where can we find you?
So Twitter is where I spend the most time. I love Twitter. Sam's_antics on Twitter. And then, you know, I have a couple different websites. So for the SEO audits and strategies, it's Voodoo Marketing, VUDU. The book is just screwthezoo.com. And then, you know, if you really want to learn how to do SEO, myseocourse.com.
Great. And a real quick question, where do you keep up with your knowledge? Like, is there any blogs that you read that you can recommend to our reader, to our listeners? Like anywhere that you have your continuing education when you learn something new?
So I've actually built out a lot of different Twitter lists of subjects and experts that I'm interested in. And so I use Twitter as sort of a personalized reality filter to help me find things from people who I know are experts in their field or who cover topics that I find interesting. Tim Ferriss tends to surface a lot of really interesting things, so I pay attention to his blog and his newsletter. I would say Derek Sivers also covers some really interesting topics. Naval Ravikant, of course. There's a guy named Rob Reed. He does a podcast called After On that is absolutely fascinating. I mean, he goes down so many interesting rabbit holes. I would definitely recommend checking that out. But tons of others, you know, on Reddit all the time, YouTube.
Reddit.
I got another question for you, though, before we finish here. So I'm looking at your audiobook, and it's read by Jim D. Johnston. Who's Jim Johnston? Why didn't you read it yourself? I just got to know.
random dude. So there's a program that Amazon does where you can get somebody to read the audiobook and you just split the audiobook proceeds with the reader.
Oh, that's a cool deal.
So you don't have to pay somebody to do it up front. So I was like, yeah, sure. And I had a bunch of people submit samples. I just liked the sound of his voice. So I had him do it.
Jim Johnson's just got a good voice. I like it. Okay.
But at some point, you know, I might re-record it and do it myself, or maybe do pieces of the book and put them out as YouTube videos.
Or at the very least, your next book could always be your solo recording too. So.
I've thought about it. I don't know what I would write. I have a couple ideas, but I don't know if I want to do another book, man. That was quite a pain in the ass.
That's, we know just from trying it.
Exactly. That's why we stop at the talking phase and we're like, wow, now we got to do all that paperwork. I got to see what's on TV. But before we close out the show, we want to find out, what are you most geeky about right now? Like a TV show, podcast, movie, book, hobby. What's your thing?
I mean, honestly, like for probably the last year, I've been spending most of my free time digging into the nature of reality, whether it's psychedelics, simulation theory, enlightenment. I'm really, really interested in what's real. So I spend a lot of time on that.
Was the Mandela Effect a good movie, or is it just a movie that asks like important questions and it kind of got you thinking? Was it actually a good movie too? I'm curious.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed the movie. I mean, it might be my second favorite after The Matrix.
Oh, wow. Have you been to Burning Man at all? Have you taken the family to Burning Man?
I never have. I should at
some point. Oh, dude, you got to take the family to Burning Man. You have to take.
How many times have you been, Andres? Tell them how many times you've been.
19.
Oh, that's awesome.
19.
I've never been either. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, Nature of Reality, something I'm also very, very interesting. Well, if you come out this way, man, you got to look me up. We have to hang out. Our families can hang out. You'll have a great time. So let me know when you're back in this area.
Will do.
Justin, what are you geeky about right now?
I just started watching You season 2 on Netflix, which is, about a psychological killer. It's basically like Dexter 2.0. I don't really know else to describe that show. I haven't watched a show in a while. I take a little bit of break because I get caught up with work, unfortunately. But it's a pretty good show, and it's got the guy that played the Penguin in Gotham is even in it at one point. So
Robin Lord Taylor.
That's the guy. Yeah, I saw him on the show, and like the mannerisms, like, oh my God, I know that guy, but I couldn't recognize him because he has like bleach blonde hair in the show. And then I'm like, when I finally clicked, I'm like, ah, the Penguin.
He's actually in the Mandela Effect as well.
Oh, no way. Oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. This is a simulated reality.
Brand, this is just so synchronicities everywhere.
I've been watching You. It's pretty good. Nice show to watch as a couple. If you have a partner, it's a good show to get into. I got two things. I've been reading the Dark Tower series, over the past few months, and I just finished the, book 5, The Wolves of the Kala. And, I don't know if you ever read that, Sam, but, that gets into alternate universes and, the multiverse theory. And, it's a great story too. So I highly recommend it if you haven't read those.
I'll have to check it out. I feel like I read maybe the first one or two as a kid, but I don't think I ever finished it.
Yeah, the first one wasn't that great. In fact, I tried the first one and I was like, but then the second one, third one, it starts to get really good, well worth my time. And then finally, I saw 1917 on IMAX. And that movie is a technical achievement. It's so good. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
Yeah.
And that's done like it's like a single shot, or it's the illusion of like a single shot the entire movie. That's what I was reading. Is that right?
Yeah, it's this immersive experience. It's Sam Mendes, who did American Beauty, and Roger Deakins, who's like one of the best cinematographers of like alive today. So it's a technical achievement. It's a great film. It's probably gonna win Best Picture. I recommend it very highly. So there you go. That's my
cool.
Does everyone feel complete on this episode? Anything else you want to add?
I could keep going for ages, but this is great.
Well, we want to have you back on, man. And like I said, get back to the Netherlands. We'll do a live remote. I would love it.
Cool.
So with that, ladies and gentlemen, another fine, fine episode of The Marketing Geeks.
That's right. That was a good one. Learning all about alternate realities, Mandela Effect, glitches in the Matrix, questioning reality. Gotta love the stuff.
What I want to know is if there is a multiverse, are the SEO techniques different in the multiverse?
great question. I've said this many times because some people know this, but not everybody. I had a very close near-death experience, and I think if there is a multiverse, this is probably like the one, maybe there's two dimensions where I survived. So this is the one where I get to be in it, though, so it's kind of nice.
Except President 45 happened. That's the trade-off.
Well, that was a result of my survival.
Trade-off. Yeah.
Direct result.
Stepped into the alternate universe. But hey, man, whatever works. Maybe you actually did die, and this is just like your flash, like your life flashing before your eyes.
It's very, very possible. I'm not saying that's not the case.
Well, with that, everybody, thank you so much for please tell people about us, leave a review, connect with Justin and I on LinkedIn, connect with Sam, and with that, we are Marketing Geeks. Out.
Stay classy.